There are two things that all of us as human beings share together, and I'm sure there are many more. One of these is life. Every one of us has 86,400 seconds in each day that we live. No one has a corner on that. No one has an advantage on that. The other thing that we share together is pain. C.S. Lewis made this perceptive observation. Pain is God's megaphone. He whispers to us in our pleasure, that is when we're happy and gay, but he shouts to us in our pain, when we are in sorrow and deep heaviness, and when we weep. That reminds me of a statement that is found over the book of Ecclesiastes in the 6th chapter, down in the 14th verse. In the day of prosperity, rejoice. And in the day of adversity, consider. Yea, God hath made the one side by side with the other to the end that man should not find out anything that shall be after him. Our lives are spent in highs and lows. But the fact of the matter is, most of life, as has been observed time and time again, is spent down in the valleys and not on the mountain peaks. And we need to thank God for the times that we rise to the top. And we should pray that he be by our side when we are down in the valleys. Our subject this evening has to do with the failure of humanism. In the process, I'm going to give you a technical, philosophical definition of humanism. But I'm really not going through the speech that was given back in the 70s against secular humanism. I'm sure you have heard those over and over again. I'm going to try and do some things that are quite practical that I hope will touch your hearts and will help you to understand the great advantage that you have in being a Bible believer and the tremendous advantage you have in being a Christian in this world today. It was Protagoras, the ancient Greek who said man is the measure of all things. And Plato said, know thyself. But later on, there was an author by the name of Alexander Pope who wrote an essay on man, and in that extended poem, he said, know then thyself, presume not God to scan. The proper study of mankind is man. There has been throughout the centuries a predisposition to think in terms of human ability, human accomplishment, human achievement. And there have been movements throughout human history, not only in recent times, but even in biblical times and back in Old Testament times, in which individuals have tried to do it their own way, to solve the problems of life, not only the day-to-day problems, but the big problems of life on their own, and somehow to perfect themselves. This definition comes from the work of John Edward Carnell, a book on the philosophy of the Christian religion. Humanism is that philosophy of life which contends that our highest known value is man. And Webster's New International Dictionary gives this definition. Humanism is a contemporary cult or belief calling itself religious, but substituting faith in man for faith in God. And really that's what we are talking about, is the religious idea of so many people that man is so great that in some sense we should actually worship him. I would suggest three characteristics of humanism that I want to highlight in order that we can bounce the lesson off of. The humanist, for all practical purposes, believes that he creates his own world. Second, he believes that God is the product of human reason. And his perspective is what the writer of the book of Ecclesiastes, the preacher, Solomon, king of Israel, called the under-the-sun perspective on life. Turn with me to the beginning of the book of Ecclesiastes and let's just read, beginning in the second verse, how he elaborates this. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. There are a lot of ways you could translate that word vanity. Futile. The very essence of futility. Empty. Vain. What profit has a man of all his labor wherein he labors under the sun? One generation goes and another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. The sun also arises and the sun goes down and hastes to its place where it arises. The wind goes toward the south and turns about to the north. It turns about continually in its course and the wind returns again to its circuits. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. Unto the place whither the rivers go, thither they go again. All things are full of weariness. Man cannot utter it. I want to share with you a little chart that is a vain effort to kind of bring together in capsule form what Solomon is saying here about life under the sun. The Bible portrays a kind of universe that the humanist is denying. And when I say humanist, I do not simply mean the philosopher in the classroom. I just mean the everyday man on the street who really thinks in terms that somehow man is the measure of all things. When he speaks of life under the sun, he is talking in terms of a three-storied universe. And this kind of universe is simply a universe that is looked upon from the standpoint of human observation. There is the realm in which man lives. There is the realm of the sun, the moon, and the stars. And there is the realm where God lives that is above that. To have a perspective of under the sun, it simply means that you live your life completely by shutting God out. Or the God that you let into your life is a God that you have made of your own creation down here under the sun. He is not a personal God. He does not seek in any sense to control your life. He does not reveal himself in Scripture, and most certainly he did not reveal himself in Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ was simply a human being who was a great man, a good man, but was not what he claimed to be. He was an imposter. He was not the Son of God. And whether one lived before the coming of Christ or after the coming of Christ, the one who lives his life under the sun, content with the idea that he can solve the great problems of life, does so on the basis of two avenues. One human experience and the other human wisdom. And Solomon tried them both. He was an individual who had all of the opportunities, all of the resources to do exactly what he wanted to do. You start out with pleasures, and he had all kinds of pleasures. But you quickly find out that those pleasures leave you unsatisfied. And eventually you are just absorbed, consumed by the trivialities, by the distractions of life. I'd like for you to notice how many times in these chapters of Ecclesiastes the expressions "I made" and "I got" are found. All of that is self-centered. All of that is human effort. And we're going to see how futile that ultimately becomes. On the other hand, Solomon because he was wise, was given the gift of being the wisest man on earth. And yet he made a fool out of himself. I want to tell you what. Wisdom, not even God's wisdom, is a guarantee that you will not be a humanist, that you will not think of yourself above what you ought to think. Human wisdom can create all kinds of problems. It can raise all kinds of issues. But most of them are unsolved and unresolved. And as a result, because we raise more questions than we can provide answers, we become disillusioned, and some people even become to the point of steeping themselves in an attitude of nihilism, if not total despair. The expressions, the catchwords in this book that suggest the pursuit of human wisdom is, I gave my heart to know this and that. Over and over again, Solomon said that. Well, of all the things he made and all of the things he got and all of the time that he spent reflecting upon the problems of life, he had to come to the end of it and say, it is vanity, it is striving for a fistful of wind. And all of us can exercise that. When we open our fist, there's nothing there. His question at the very beginning is, what profit? What is there left over? What is the residue? What is there of value of all the labor wherein he labors under the sun? And every one of us has to ask himself honestly this question. What profit has your life produced up to this particular point? And I don't care what you do. I'm asking this to every person who preaches the gospel in here. I have spent my lifetime studying the Bible, and yet I am standing here to confess to you that because of my mental disposition at times, very much of that study has been in vain. It has been to gain knowledge. It has not really been to serve my fellow man or to sincerely devote myself to God. It has been because I wanted to know more and more. I wanted to know this and that about Bible geography. I wanted to know this and that about the customs of ancient people. I wanted to know this and that about everything that I could. But sometimes I doubt seriously that I really wanted to do that for the glory of God. There are two things that I want to kind of concentrate on. One is self-indulgence. That is one of the characteristics of an individual who begins to think only and entirely on man. Now, not every person who would call himself a humanist is self-indulgent. But there certainly is an open door for that. On the other hand, there is the matter of the search for human perfectibility. And it's going on as intensely, if not more intensely today than it ever was. Exercise, diet, clothes, self-help books, surgery, you name it. We try it. What are we trying to do? We're trying to somehow get rid of the imperfections that mar us, both physically and spiritually. What really happens, however, in this regard is that sooner or later, if we're not careful, we begin to be motivated by the pleasure principle. The pleasure principle demands immediate satisfaction. I want it instantly. I want it accessible. I want it intensely right now. And the thing that strengthens pleasure and really gives it its propulsion is freedom. Pleasure overpowers even those most set on conquering it. Because we cannot handle absolute freedom. And so, as we begin to look at this, perhaps it is better to start with a very light note before we get into some heavy stuff. There's a little book called The University of Hard Knocks by an author named Ralph Parlett. You've never read that. It's an old book. Find a copy of it somewhere and read it. Out of the second chapter called The College of Needless Knocks, under the subtitle, The Bumps That We Bump Into, Parlett describes himself when he was a little boy. And here he goes. There comes a vivid memory of one of my early needless knocks as I say that. It was back at the time when I was trying to run our home to suit myself. He was a humanist. I sat in the highest chair in the family circle. I was 3 years old and ready to graduate. That day, they had the little joy and sunshine of the family in his high chair thrown right up beside the dinner table. The coffee pot was within grabbing distance. I became enamored with that coffee pot. I decided I needed that coffee pot in my business. I reached over to get the coffee pot. Then I discovered a woman beside me, my mother. She was the most meddlesome woman I had ever known. I had not tried to do one thing in 3 years that that woman had not meddled into. And that day, when I wanted the coffee pot, oh, I wanted the coffee pot. Nobody knows how I desired that coffee pot. One thing thou lackest, a coffee pot. I was reaching over to get it. That woman said, "Don't touch that." The longer I thought about it, the more angry I became. What right has that woman to meddle into my life all the time? I have stood this parrot petticoat tyranny 3 years, and it's time to stop it. I stopped it. In fact, I got the coffee pot. I know I got the coffee pot. I got it unanimously. I know when I got it, and I know also where I got it. I got about a gallon of the reddest, hottest coffee a bad boy ever spilled over himself. Oh, I can feel it yet. There were weeks after that when I was upholstered. They put apple butter on me and coal oil and the white of an egg and starch and anything else the neighbors could think of. They would bring it over and rub it on the little joy and sunshine of the family who had temporarily gotten eclipsed. And we all laugh. But I want to tell you what, we all bear our scars of foolishness. I don't know if you've ever noticed or not, but I bear a pretty wicked scar on my forehead. That is a monument to my disobedience to my mother. She left home, and she says, "Whatever you do, don't ride your bicycle to town." And I said, "Who are you to tell me?" Not directly. She would have beat the living daylights out of me. But who are you to tell me not to ride my bicycle downtown? And I did. And I got whomped by a truck. No, that's not exactly right. I whomped the truck. Racing along with my head down, I looked up and here was a mail truck parked right out in front of me. And the guy yelled to me from behind and he said something. And I turned around, he said, "Watch out for the truck." And I turned around and I said, "What truck?" And about that time I hit it. I got that truck. I know when I got it and I know where I got it. And I had about 22 of the awfulest stitches you've ever imagined, without any anesthesia. And I also have a crease in my head. Somebody like Harry would call it a hole in my head. I won't finish that thought. But the problem with all of this is that we just really are never satisfied by our experiences. Going on down in that first chapter in the 8th verse, Solomon said, "All things are full of weariness, man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing." There just is not any satisfaction to these kind of desires that we have. And this is the way God has made us. Because unless we realize that we cannot satisfy ourselves, we will never really turn to Him in dependence to find our full satisfaction. Now, I'm going to share with you some ideas that I have taken out of this book that I've referred to several times. John Carnell's book, A Philosophy of the Christian Religion. He has this little description of why the pleasure principle does not work that is the finest thing I've ever seen on this subject. And I want to share it with you. And I hope that I can do half the justice that he does in that book concerning it. The first step in the pleasure principle is boredom. The basis of boredom is freedom. Freedom gives man the glory, but is the source of his uneasiness. We feel that we are under the oppression of limitations. Mentally, we can do anything we desire to do. But we find ourselves not only physically limited, but mentally limited, and certainly we do not want to be externally limited by the commandments of God. But the very fact that we can think out of freedom, and the very fact that we can, in our mind, do all sorts of things, we become rather quickly bored as a result of that. Boredom is the weariness of spirit, writes Carnell, that results when freedom is repetitiously related to an unsatisfying pleasure. I have the freedom to do it, so I do it. That doesn't satisfy me. I have the freedom to do something else, and so I do it. And that doesn't satisfy me. And the next thing you know, I'm just absolutely bored to death. I'm not so old that I can't remember, as a teenager, pacing up and down inside the house, hoping that one of my friends was coming by to take me somewhere to do something because I was bored to death. Now, I'm sure none of you young people are ever like that, though. But listen to this. Down in the 9th verse, he goes on to say, "That which has been is that which shall be, and that which hath been done is that which shall be done, and there is no new thing under the sun. Is there a thing whereof it may be said, see, this is new, it has been long ago in the ages which were before us?" I spent about 3 generations teaching college students. And I had a very unique experience by doing that because I saw 3 generations of students that were totally unaware of what the previous generation had done, who tried to do the greatest prank that the world has ever seen. And it was kind of humorous when they would do it, and you had seen it 40 years before that. Because there really isn't anything new under the sun. Now, earlier students may have put a Model T on the stage, and 2 generations later they may have put a Volkswagen on the stage, because both automobiles are relatively light to carry, and enough boys that don't have any energy to channel toward their studies can move one around pretty good. But it doesn't make a difference whether it's a Model T or whether or not it's a Volkswagen or what it is. It's the same old thing. I can just imagine a bunch of boys in Egypt about 3000 B.C. chattering to one another in the Egyptian language or writing in hieroglyphics, talking about this prank they were going to pull. They were going to put a camel in Pharaoh's court. It's all the same thing. We get bored. And there are all kinds of options before us. There are more options than we can possibly have the time and energy to accomplish, and so therefore we get frustrated. I want to tell you, my worst experience in life is to be sent by my wife on the spur of the moment down to the grocery store to get some soap so she can finish the laundry. And she's in a hurry and she wants me to get out of the house and go down and get it. And I ask her, "Well, honey, what do you want?" She said, "Well, just get the cheapest thing, whatever's on sale." And I go down to one of these super grocery stores, and I stand there in front of the aisle, and I'm just absolutely intimidated because all I see are boxes of soap that are all the same color. And so I start down the line, and I'm looking for one, and every last one of them cost $6.95. So I just pick one up off of the shelf, and I take it home, and she says, "Honey, why did you get that? You know I don't use that." Well, no, I don't know that she doesn't use that. But the fact of the matter is, there were all these options, and I didn't know what to do, and I wasn't going to take the time to call her up on the telephone, so I just grabbed one. And life is like that. We just reach out and we grab something, because somehow we think that it'll be the right thing to do. And we get absolutely frustrated in all of these choices. Now, the problem with boredom and frustration is that sooner or later, we just keep trying to pump ourselves up and do something a little more daring this time than we did last time, until before long we do something that can be physically destructive to us. A sad thing happened last year. There were 2 young high school boys. They had gotten out of school and they had stopped by to get a hamburger And they were just cutting up with one another, and this boy was driving the car, and they left the hamburger joint, and this kid said, "I want to see how fast this car will go by the time I can hit the interstate once I start on the ramp." And he put his foot in the carburetor, and he took off, and he got it up to 90 miles an hour, and he blew a tire, went all the way into the air, hit a tree directly on, and killed his friend who was begging him to slow down. And he has to live with that the rest of his life. He just wanted to go 90 miles an hour. But sad to say, there are things that damage us spiritually because we just want to break loose and do what we can. And then there is guilt. Guilt just weighs down very heavily on us. And we just cannot get rid of it. We need to understand that we become who we are through external forces and through free will. And if we're not careful, we will make scars in our lives that we cannot get rid of. If I ask you to do so, I do not hesitate to think for a moment that you would have any trouble of conjuring up the worst thing you ever did in your life, because it's tucked right here in your mind. Now, you may have the complete confidence that God has forgiven you of that deed, but you will never, ever get rid of the psychological scar. That's the way God made us. And in that great computer bank, it will be there as long as we live. Perhaps that's one of the blessings of senility, when we come to old age and we can't remember those things. But guilt is God-given. It is a result of a bad conscience. It is in hope that somehow we will seek to remove the pain and that we'll accept His solution for the pain. There is a fourth step, however. When an individual has lived a life of guilt and has just somehow tried to accustom himself to that, because he is so involved in pleasure, in doing this and doing that, and he has the energy to do it, so that he can kind of divert his attention from this matter of guilt and this pain of the soul, until finally he begins to realize the body is wearing out and the mind is wearing out, and the body wears out before the mind wears out. If you ever visit an old folks' home, now, I know that that's probably not politically correct way to call that now, but they're old people, and they're two kinds. Most of them have lived a life of sin and are laden with guilt. They're physically exhausted. Sometimes they don't even have any family that comes to visit them. Oh, they may have kids, but they don't ever bother to go out of their way to go see them, and they just sit there. And though their bodies make it impossible for them to do anything about it, they just think in terms of all of the things that they have done that they wish they hadn't done. And they are miserable, unhappy creatures. They are begging to die, and they can't do anything about it, because they're going to go on living in an exhausted body, thinking about what they should have done otherwise. And then there are a few who are just as happy as they can be, because even if they made bad choices, they repented of those, they changed their lives, they trusted in the Lord, were cleansed by His blood, and they're redeemed and rejoice as a result of that. Now, we're all going to face the end of life, and we're going to be in one or two of those categories, and we are making that determination now as to exactly which one of them we're going to be in. But I want to suggest to you that there is something else that is eating away at us, more than just the pleasures that we would like to fulfill. These are the great problems of life that we wish that we could do something about. I do not have any time at all to elaborate on this, but I just simply want to list these hard facts for you. And you can find them over there in the third and the fourth chapters of Ecclesiastes. Read those chapters carefully. God gave them in order for us to reflect upon ourselves and upon life. First of all, we lament the fact that there's no justice in the world. There's wickedness present, but it seems as though those individuals who are wicked get by with it. If you don't have any money, it seems as though you're just going to have to go to jail. If you have a lot of money, if you can buy you a dream team, somehow you can beat the rap. That's not right. But that's a fact of life. And people are hopeless and helpless in the face of disease and death. And ultimately, they come to realize that in final analysis, if all they have is life under the sun, their death is about that of a beast. They exhale their breath, and that's the end of it. And all of the oppressed people on the face of the earth, and their name is Legion, have no comforter. When they're down and out, they often have to go it alone. And there is all this competition in the world, and we live in a society that is just honed to competition. Human envy and rivalry comes out of that, and there is no rest for the soul. And all the lonely people in the world, the people who would love to have companionship, who would love to be married but have never been chosen, and who have to live their life without a single person at their side. And then there's those people that rise to the top. They are very successful in what they do, only to find someone else who comes along who is better than they are, and the people just instantly turn away from them and follow after this new person. Why do so many entertainers turn to drugs? For that very reason. One day they're at the top of the charts, everybody is applauding them, they're coming to hear them in concerts by the hundreds of thousands, and the next day they are nothing, and they can't take that. The group is off following another band. And don't tell me we don't do that with those people. Because we're the ones that get fed up with the songs because we're bored with them after we've heard them 50 times. And so we go out and buy a new album, buy a new group. And here's the old group that's off there drinking alcohol and taking drugs because they can't stand it that they're out of the limelight. It was Glenn Campbell who said that he desired to be a rhinestone cowboy. I want to be where the lights are shining on me. When they're not shining on me anymore, you know, you tend to just fall apart. It's these problems of life that we would like to solve that we can't solve. One of my favorite movies is kind of in a trilogy of movies done by a playwright or a screenwriter, I should say, who is quite fascinating to me. One of these, I guess the first one that he did was To Kill a Mockingbird, a very fine movie. The next in line, I believe, was Tender Mercies with Robert Duvall as an actor. And then the third of the movies that was done was Trip to Bountiful. This movie, Tender Mercies, fascinates me. It's a down-and-out country western singer who has gone to alcohol because he wrote the songs, but people loved to hear other people singing those songs, especially his own wife, and he turned to alcohol, and he began to beat his wife and abuse his wife. And eventually, she divorced him. And he has turned to the bottom. He's estranged from his family and from his daughter, and the time comes in which he goes out to Texas, he's drunk in a motel, and wakes up and his partner's gone off to leaving, footing the bill, and he doesn't have any money, and he begs this young woman who is a widow, her husband was killed in the Vietnam War, and she has a small boy named Sonny, if he can't just do some handy work around and fix the place up, and eventually he does and stays, and they marry. He is reunited with his daughter, and things seem to be going good. In fact, he writes some songs, and one of them is becoming a hit, and he's just riding on cloud nine, when all of a sudden he gets a telephone call and his daughter has been killed in an automobile accident. And so he goes out in the yard and out into the garden and starts hoeing. It's a marvelous scene. His wife, Tess, comes out and says, "Mac, are you okay?" Then Mac says, "I was almost killed once in a car accident. I was drunk and ran off the road, and I turned over 4 times. And they took me out of that car for dead, but I lived. And I prayed last night to know why I lived and my daughter died. But I got no answer to my prayer. I still don't know why she died and I lived. I don't know the answer to nothing. Not a blessed thing. I don't know why I wandered out to this part of Texas drunk and you took me in and pitied me and helped me to straighten out and married me. Why? Why did that happen to me? Is there a reason that that happened?" And Sonny's daddy died in the war. And he hoes a little bit and he says, "And my daughter killed in an automobile accident. Why?" "You see, I don't trust happiness. I never did, and I never will." And it's really interesting that Robert Duvall wrote most of the songs for that movie, and playing in the background almost all the way through, and while he is giving that speech, are these words to a song that he wrote, "It's Hard to Face Reality." And truly it is. Wittgenstein, one of this generation's philosophers, said the sense of the world must lie outside the world. And that's exactly what Solomon tells us. After coming to the end of the way and realizing that all was vanity, that neither through his experiences nor his wisdom had he solved the problems of life, Solomon drew this conclusion. In chapter 12, verse 13, "This is the end of the matter. All has been heard. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this will make a person whole." If you try to live your life without God, you will only be half a person. The only way to be full, the only way to be complete, the only way to be happy is to live your life in the service of God, loving Him with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your soul, and with all your strength, and loving your neighbor as yourself.